to spend a little bit of time with, because it is one of the issues that bedevils us as pension managers, and that is that when we talk to people among our stakeholder base, or quite frankly in the legislature, we find that oftentimes we run up against paradigms that are applied to PERS that don't fit. You know, PERS is complex. I hope I've made that point. It's big, it's complex, and when you face something like that, I always like to use some kind of simplifying construct. It's like this or it's like that to help me figure out what it means. But if you choose the wrong rule of thumb or construct or paradigm, it can lead you to bad conclusions. And I jokingly mentioned that a lot of people thought that the Earth was flat, so they refused to sail west. So they missed out on Miami Beach. And, you know, some people thought that, that illness was caused by bad blood. So they basically drained the blood out of their loved ones. You know, you had the wrong paradigm, it can lead you to the wrong cure. And the three that most people in the world deal with, certainly in our stakeholder universe, the paradigms that they like to apply to PERS is the private business P&L. Well, it doesn't work for us, and I'll show you why in a minute. Another is a public operating budget, which you're very familiar with having to deal with the tremendous budgetary issues that are before you, particularly this year. But it doesn't, that paradigm doesn't work for us either. The labor management contract, which many of our members live and die by, that are very important to them, it's a construct that they live with. The problem is it doesn't work for PERS either. It really failed. All three of these paradigms can lead you to the wrong conclusions about what PERS does. And on page 32, I do my best to emphasize that we're in the long-term contract business. And by contract, I mean small c, not the legal contract rights issue. But on behalf of you as representatives of the state government, as well as local governments, we execute 5 to 50 year long-term contracts with each and every public employee. They're long-lived. They're very difficult, if not impossible, to retrospectively renegotiate. You can't trade off things that you got in the past for something that you get in the future, as you sometimes can, for example, in labor negotiations. At least you can't within the pension construct. And they are ultimately the responsibility of their sponsors, which in this case is the state, cities, and counties in the state of Oregon. And if you don't use the contract notion when you think about PERS, you underestimate its importance and you underestimate the long tail of consequences that comes when you make a change or put a revision into place. And it's for you to decide, but when you look at the statutory history, there certainly have been a lot of changes, and I think it's reasonable to say that some of them, some of the consequences of those changes might have surprised the authors, and I can't say, only the authors can say. But I do want to compare on page 39 why they're so different. You know, one is the duration, how long they last, and another is the ability to change them. And if I could jump down to PERS, obviously we have the longest duration of any financial decision that's made under these other regimes or constructs. We also have the least ability to control near-term costs, because many of the costs, in fact, most of the costs, most of that $1.6 billion that we put out the door each year, in fact, all of it, really, as well as a substantial amount of the contributions that we require employers and members to pay, were set in place in 1980, 1985, 1990, 1995, and so on. And so many of the changes that the legislature might consider, if it was in your desire, I think we have to realize that short-term effects are not likely to be great. I'm not saying that there's none, but I'm saying that in general, the way pensions are constructed, and particularly the way PERS is constructed, the payoff to the state of changes that you or your colleagues would seem desirable are likely to emerge over time, not in the first day that they are executed. I do want to end on an up note, if I could, because PERS is a successful institution, and I think given the controversy that surrounds us for all the 15 reasons I've just said, that said, that accepted, we deliver pension benefits that compare very, very well to those provided to other public employees. It's not for us to decide whether they're the right ones or the wrong ones. That's your purview, but we do it. And comparisons will bear that out. We also know that we have tremendous administrative challenges because of our rapid growth, our size, and particularly our complexity. But I'd like to believe, and here I'm a tainted witness, that the operation is run with a high degree of professionalism, objectivity, and integrity. People might not like the outcomes that that we produce, but I would hope that they would say that we are very diligent in pursuing our best understanding of what the statute requires us to do. And I also want to make sure, and this is very important, because that $1.6 billion that we send goes out to people that are on fixed incomes. My father is 85 years old, and I know the mindset. They worry, and they have reason to worry, because they're no longer in the working world. And I want to make it clear that the benefit promises that we have made to date, despite the financial issues that we have, are backed by substantial assets. They are professionally managed, in fact, with an excellent investment plan. They are guarded by people and institutions that, in my judgment, have high integrity. And I think that, you know, again, the forest for the trees, you need to step back and make sure that these ought not to be issues, in my humble opinion. Now, that said, in the vein of humility, my staff has been behind me chalking down all of the mistakes that I have made, large or small, and they will gather with me after this day. And if I have committed any big boo-boos, I will communicate back to the committee and make sure that the record is clear, because this system is humbling. It is so complex. And I have no doubt that they have a list back there that they've been tidily keeping, and they're ready to pounce on the director as soon as he gets into the hall and say, that was not quite right. So expect a letter back from me with clarifications. And I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. Recall that my chair is here as well, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jim. I do have questions, and I know we were going to go over this timeline. I think I'm going to dispense with that timeline today and let people just absorb it for a while. I know you'll be back with us at a later date, and if we have questions in the meantime, I'm sure we can get to you. But I have a series of questions that I'd like to just explore today before we get to your board chair. And the first of which is, there have been articles written and things that I've read that indicate that the original traditional PERS formula was intended to give a retiree 50% of final salary after 30 years on the job. Is that a true statement?
Chair Knopp, I'm not positive. Again, we spend most of our time with the 64,000 words in the statute, because the statute, at the end of the day, we've been advised by our attorneys, and it's my experience, trumps intent or commentary that was made at the time. So maybe it's a lack of diligence on our part in terms of going back and doing that historical research. But quite frankly, we've had our hands full trying to understand the statute, and we know the statute is controlling. So in point of fact, I'm not sure is the answer.
I would like an answer to that question, if possible. And the only reason for that is I just want to know if it's a true statement or not, because I know it gets repeated a lot, and either it's true or it's not, and I would like some clarity to that. The other statement that I've read and heard is that in the year 2000, for the first time, longtime employees retired with bigger checks than they earned on the job, as pensions averaged 6% above final salaries. Does that ring true to you?
I suspect that, and this is conjecture now, that the year 2000 was the first time we had notable numbers of people doing that. I cannot say that in 97, 98, 99, there were no instances of that. That would be overstating the case. I'd have to go back. But we can actually give you the data on the precise number of people who retired at amounts higher than their final average salary. We have done that in response to inquiries by your colleagues in the legislature.
I'm sure people will be interested in that.
Mr. Chair, follow up on that one point. There's additional reporting requirements, additional work that has to be done for those folks. Can you briefly tell us what that might be, additional exposure that the system has to actually do to convince the Internal Revenue Service that that's the correct distribution?
That is correct, Representative Butler. In fact, if you look at page 4 of the presentation, there's something called the Benefit Equalization Fund. That is actually a separate trust fund. A separate trust fund that we have had to set up, and it is designed to accommodate IRS requirements for what the IRS calls excess benefits, and that are taxable. So, in fact, we're in the tax collection business as well, too. We handle 1099s, we collect taxes and withholding, because under IRS rules, there are certain levels of pension benefits that are subject to taxation. You've exhausted my technical knowledge on the topic, but we certainly could expand on that if it's of interest to you. But it is another example of the complexity of our fund, that there's a separate trust fund to deal with just this group. It's a small group right now. It happens to be the fastest growing group in our membership base.
Can I sign up for it?
Other questions? The 600 accounts that you currently have, do those get audited from time to time for accuracy? And I assume that they do. So if so, what's the result of that? And will that incur, will that incur more employer reimbursements that are necessary?
Chairman Canope, we do get audited on a regular basis, both regular financial audits as well as periodic audits addressing special topics by the Audits Division. We also have an internal audit staff, which the legislature was kind enough to allow us to expand when we requested an expansion of that effort in the last budget cycle, and I want to thank you for that because it's been very important. So we have two sets of auditing teams, and our internal auditors work 24, all the weeks of the year. We have actually had the Audits Division on site more or less continuously for all the time that I've been director the last 2 years. We did something innovative this last year. We actually, I actually asked the Audits Division to double the size of the benefit calculation audit, a special audit that they were doing, and they graciously conceded, and we cooperatively constructed the sampling of benefit transactions to meet both of the needs of the Audits Division and PERS. And that audit is not ready yet, but I think it's fair to say that it will show an error rate that quite frankly, as somebody who's been involved in financial institutions for several decades, is too high. Whether that's costly for employers, I would have to say that it's more the integrity of the data and the fact that it's a tremendous blow to productivity at the agency, because every time we find an error, remember, to obey the statute, we've got to go back and fix it. There is no error too small, really, to not require under law correcting. So it's quite a burden for us, and you're touching on one of my favorite topics. The infrastructure at PERS to execute its job is way below what's required by an institution of its size and complexity.
A couple other questions that come to mind based on that. These calculations that are made, are those done? How are those done? And is there a cost to improving the process, those calculations? It sounded like from your first answer that maybe the hardware might be behind the times or something.
Chairman Canope, presently about 35 or 40% of our calculations require manual, meaning a standalone PC separate from the mainframe, or a hand calculator, or even paper and pencil. About 35 or 40% of our transactions require some manual execution. The staff also jokingly refers to those that are all manual as manuals. It's not my preferred way of running a financial institution, but it reflects the severe limitations of our 1980s data processing technology. Unfortunately, because we've had spent nothing on CapEx at PERS out of the trust fund to rebuild the infrastructure of the agency to do its job, we have accumulated a very large capital spending deficiency. it's large enough that it causes people at the legislature qualms when we discuss what's needed in our judgment to execute the business requirements. It's also risky because technology is the only way for financial record keeping to go if you want any semblance of productivity, accuracy, and auditability. But as you all know, technology projects are risky. So you have to be careful. You have to be thoughtful. And we are currently engaged and have been engaged with the legislature for both 4 or 5 years in an attempt to try to start what will probably be a 5 to 7 year investment, reinvestment in rebuilding the infrastructure PERS. It won't be cheap. I'm not going to tell you what maybe some people would like to hear, but the fact is that doing nothing, quite frankly, is not an option given the continued growth in the size of the program and its complexity, particularly if the legislature would like to make any additional changes in either the core statute or some additional plan or plan structure, which has been discussed from time to time. We're not well positioned to execute the will of the legislature from an implementation point of view.
Are those capital expenditures paid for by the trust then when you do make them?
Chairman Knope, the answer is absolutely yes. We are a closed circle. We only provide services to our stakeholders, by and large, and we only gain funding from our stakeholders via access to the trust fund. But that access is controlled carefully by both DAS and by the legislature.
And there is no general fund coming to your agency?
We are a net contributor to general fund agencies through our purchases of services from other state agencies. Now, that's putting aside, however, the PERS contributions that the program pulls in. But from an administrative point of view, I believe we're a net contributor to the general fund.
How many employees does the agency have?
Approximately 215. We always have some temps operating because we have strong peaks and valleys in our transaction rates, and we always have special projects going, normally what I call legacy projects, which are going back and recalculating benefits either because of court decisions. The Young case is an example where 2,000 individuals had to either have their retirements recalculated or their accounts rebuilt over time because of that judicial decision, that judicial settlement. HB 3349 required us to unretire and re-retire approximately, I think it was 10,000 individuals. So we always have what I call legacy projects going.
What's your annual administrative operating budget?
It's roughly $20 million. I believe it's $40 million or so per biennium, but I don't have the figure. I'll answer specifically and give you a breakdown. I would suspect that Representative Butler probably knows it better than I do.
Do you guys own or rent a building, and where is that located?
We have our own building. It's a small building just off the freeway in Tiger.
Okay. The one thing we haven't talked a lot about today is mortality tables. I assume you use them to calculate benefits, and if so, can you tell us when those mortality tables are from, and is there any talk of updating those?
Chairman Knope, let me step back and say first that give you some context about how we use mortality tables and then talk about the issue that's currently before the board. In most defined benefit plans that are traditional and very straightforward, mortality tables don't play a very big role because a monthly benefit is driven directly from years of service, for example, and final salary, like full formula. So mortality tables play a minor role when you're talking about how long a beneficiary might live or some ancillary part of the pension world. Under money match, however, the pension benefit accumulates over time in the form of a cash account, a balance, if you will. And then at the point of retirement, the question is, well, what's the monthly payment that comes from this benefit? Well, what does it translate into? And that's where mortality tables come into play. And there's as many opinions about this topic as you would like to hear. Some people argue that the mortality table that we should use should reflect exactly how long we expect that person to live. Other folks say that the statute and various court cases require us to use the mortality tables that were in place years ago when that account, when that portion of the account was created. There's the IRS has a point of view that we're investigating right now to understand better that says you can't lower a person's benefit by changing mortality tables, meaning what it would have been had they retired back at the date of the change, the accrued benefit notion. It's a very complex topic, but I think the point I'd like to leave with you is that there's several points. One is that under money match and under Oregon's peculiar system, mortality tables play a very, very large role. I mean, $1 billion type role, or $500 million, depending on the policy question or policy option at hand. So it's very important to our particular system. The second thing is that the statute is, again, not terribly clear. In one part of the statute, it says we're supposed to use actuarially appropriate in an actuarially sound manner. However, there's also the IRS to consider. There's the as yet unknown and not totally defined issue of what contract rights under the Oregon Constitution would permit. This is an issue that I think it's fair to say, and my board chair can address this, has been a difficult one for the board and the agency to get its arms around because of the many sources of potential or actual authority over what we can and can't do about mortality tables. And it deserves, it is so complex that it deserves an hour or so discussion all by itself. And I'd be happy to give you, as Representative Smith said, maybe some materials to explain sort of how we got to this point in the mortality debate and then sort of take the task force from that point forward, if that's the best way to proceed. But I will say it is an important issue, and we anticipated that you'd have questions about it.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and discuss this.
We'll call Chair of the First Board, Don Morgan.
Chair, while Ms. Morgan is coming forward, I just want to express my appreciation for Director Voitko having come today, and I know that he's given this presentation and other presentations a number of times, and I do want to express my personal appreciation for the good job that he's doing. And I know that this is not necessarily a job that doesn't come with a great deal of mudslinging and perhaps even some dodging of the scattergun bullets as well as the direct hits. So I do appreciate his willingness to cooperate and appear today.
As do I. Chair Morgan.
Thank you. My name is Don Morgan, and I was elected chair of the PERS board this January.
Sure it wasn't a sentence, sir.
Well, I have to say that when offered congratulations, I have said I wasn't sure that it shouldn't have been condolences. It is, in fact, a mixed blessing. I would like to give you just a little bit of background about me personally, and then I'll get into my formal remarks. I am a 28-year employee of the state of Oregon. I started in the mailroom, and I am now the training coordinator for the part of the state, the Disability Determination Services, that administers the Social Security Disability Program for the state. So I am familiar with complicated systems. I teach people how to make disability decisions under the Social Security Act. However, in my 3.5 years on the PERS board, I have to say that this certainly beats that all hollow. It is incredibly complicated. The learning curve is almost straight up. It is a responsibility that is sometimes incredibly daunting in that you bear the responsibility for the pension obligation for literally thousands of people. And as Jim said, it is their largest, for the most part, their largest financial asset. And that tends to keep your mind focused. And what I want to do today, as you've asked me to provide information regarding the role of the PERS board, and I would like to explain a little bit about how we carry out your mandate to administer the system, because that is our responsibility, is the administration of the PERS system. But that's only a starting place for explaining how we go about that. Jim has touched on a number of the points that we have to decide, but I want to carry that a little bit further. But in your packet, you have the values, guiding principles, and goals for the PERS board, and I'm going to use that and summarize some of the more important pieces of that, but I do hope that you'll take the time to read this. It was adopted unanimously in February of 2001 following extensive study and input from all of our stakeholders. And I realize that these kinds of documents frequently exist, especially in public bodies, as sort of just pieces of paper. But for PERS and our staff, it is much more than a casual statement about our mission, but it serves as guideposts to assure that both the board and the staff conform to all the legal and ethical requirements because of our huge responsibility to the members of the trust. I'd like to summarize these key points, but I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. It's lighter reading than some of the stuff in your packet, and it's well footnoted. So there is an explanation of how we got to the places we got in the document. Now, you've heard people use the term fiduciary duty. And that is used a lot in discussing our role, and it is the primary and overriding responsibility of the board as trustees of the retirement funds of the majority of public employees in our state. And that duty is of undivided loyalty to the members of the PERS Trust Fund. That's a responsibility rooted in common law, but to the best of my understanding, goes back to Charles Dickens' day. And it's to assure that people who have responsibility for other people's money don't take advantage for either personal gain or, in this instance, for the enrichment of the employer. Now, I do think that we have seen in the news lately some examples of what very well may be that in the Enron cases. There is some significant questions about those, whether the trustees of their pension fund, in fact, fiddled around with their money in order to advantage their employer and disadvantage the employees. In Portland, there's currently a pension fund case in which the trustees abused their responsibility for their own enrichment. So fiduciary responsibility is a clear and present responsibility for us. It's one of the first things they explain to you when they come, you come on the board, is your responsibility is solely the members of the trust. Now, the Oregon courts have ruled that employers, although they participate in the fund, are not members of the trust. That is frequently difficult to understand because they're one of the primary funders. The courts have said they have a different status from our perspective. Any actions of the board have to be measured against the requirement to protect and secure the assets of the fund for the benefit of its members. And I will give you an example of just how tight that requirement is. Judge Lipscomb, in his recent summary judgment on a case dealing in one instance with fiduciary duty of the board, said that when the board made rules that put the employers in the variable fund, that even though that cost on average no more than $25 apiece for Tier 1 or Tier 2 members, and it actually advantaged Tier 1 members, that that was abuse of our duty because it was made more for the benefit of the employer than it was for the employee. So this is a responsibility that the courts keep very tight rein on, and for which we're told by the lawyers when we come on the board, if we ignore the advice of our attorneys and violate our duty, we are personally responsible and the state will not provide us with a defense. So that is a sobering responsibility when you come onto this board. Now, in order to satisfy that duty, you have to comply with both state and federal laws. And that means that, as Jim has said, we spend a lot of time looking at statutes. That presents a challenge when the statute is vague, when it's contradictory, or when it's silent. An example of this came up recently when we had to look at how to credit a deficit, something we've never had to do. When we asked the lawyers to look at this, they told us that it, in 42 places in the statute, it talks about how you credit interest, how you credit income, and how you credit earnings, but there is no reference to how you credit negative balances. Okay, well, since they talk about it 42 places, you've got 42 places that can disagree with one another in the interpretation of where you credit that negative balance. In our attempts to determine the intent of the statute, we now have significant questions about what has been our long-term crediting policy. Because when you read it only from a positive balance, you can reach different conclusions than when you have to look at it from the reverse. That does not lead to a lot of confidence on the part of our stakeholders when we present responsibility for us. It's one of the first things they explain to you when they come, you come on the board, is your responsibility is solely the members of the trust. Now, the Oregon courts have ruled that employers, although they participate in the fund, are not members of the trust. That is frequently difficult to understand because they're one of the primary funders. The courts have said they have a different status from our perspective. Any actions of the board have to be measured against the requirement to protect and secure the assets of the fund for the benefit of its members. And I will give you an example of just how tight that requirement is. Judge Lipscomb, in his recent summary judgment on a case dealing in one instance with fiduciary duty of the board, said that when the board made rules that put the employers in the variable fund, that even though that cost on average no more than $25 apiece for Tier 1 or Tier 2 members, and it actually advantaged Tier 1 members, that that was abuse of our duty because it was made more for the benefit of the employer than it was for the employee. So this is a responsibility that the courts keep very tight rein on, and for which we're told by the lawyers when we come on the board, if we ignore the advice of our attorneys and violate our duty, we are personally responsible and the state will not provide us with a defense. So that is a sobering responsibility when you come onto this board. Now, in order to satisfy that duty, you have to comply with both state and federal laws. And that means that, as Jim has said, we spend a lot of time looking at statutes. That presents a challenge when the statute is vague, when it's contradictory, or when it's silent. An example of this came up recently when we had to look at how to credit a deficit, something we've never had to do. When we asked the lawyers to look at this, they told us that it, in 42 places in the statute, it talks about how you credit interest, how you credit income, and how you credit earnings, but there is no reference to how you credit negative balances. Okay, well, since they talk about it 42 places, you've got 42 places that can disagree with one another in the interpretation of where you credit that negative balance. In our attempts to determine the intent of the statute, we now have significant questions about what has been our long-term crediting policy. Because when you read it only from a positive balance, you can reach different conclusions than when you have to look at it from the reverse. that does not lead to a lot of confidence on the part of our stakeholders when we say, after all these years, now we're not sure. However, the absolute need to administer the fund legally requires that we, in fact, question our established policy, we fully explore the issue, and if necessary, we change both our policies and any administrative rules that apply. We have no choice. The statute also requires that the fund be actuarially sound. You've heard about that a little bit already. I also have to say that actuaries speak a different language and think differently because they think 30 years in the future, something that is very difficult for most of us to understand. Luckily, we have an actuary that speaks English, which is very good. Most of them speak actuarial. In 2001, we have a long-term actuary, but in 2001, we engaged an outside actuarial firm to perform an actuarial audit. This is considered sound practice, and it yielded a solid affirmation of the performance of Milliman USA and Mark Johnson, who's our primary actuary. Now, as I've said, in fiduciary duty, we don't have the right to make changes solely to affect either benefits or costs. That's not part of our charge. But we must base such considerations on the solid, sound judgment of our actuary. Based on such advice, the board is currently attempting to determine, as you've heard, the most appropriate method to use in order to change our outdated mortality tables. In making such changes, however, all the other considerations I'm going to talk about that comprise our fiduciary duty must be met. I have to say, this has proven to be a daunting, difficult task, because it seems that at every turn, we have had complications, confusion, contradictions in the statute, and difficulty understanding exactly what will best meet our fiduciary duty in making that change. We understand the need to make it. We actually thought it would be relatively straightforward, but it is not. It is incredibly complicated. A corollary to the need to satisfy state laws is, as you have, I'm sure, heard until you wish you hadn't heard it, the need to consider the rights of members to certain benefits. It's commonly called contract rights. Now, this is unsettled and very volatile, as Oregon courts have not fully defined what is within a contract right. It is open to much interpretation, depending on which side you would like it to fall. However, because of the potential of lengthy class action litigation, we've been there, we've done that, costs a lot of money, takes a lot of time, and upsets a lot of people. Coupled with the cost of the system, should that litigation reverse the actions of the board, because as you've heard, it costs us a lot of money to go back and recalculate benefits. Decisions that have the potential to affect benefits have to be very carefully considered. I've spent more time listening to lawyers than I care to think about in this as well as all these other areas. Now, final consideration, and Jim touched on this also, is the fiduciary duty to maintain our PERS tax qualification status. Because we are so unique among public pension systems, the code is not at all clear about how it applies, and it is not at all clear what changes are in fact legal and what are not. It's not possible to learn from the experience of others because no one has a plan that's exactly like ours, and the money match plan in particular, even though it exists in a couple of other plans, it's incredibly small, and it does not drive the majority of their decisions. We have asked for that information. It doesn't exist. The code is set up and addresses primarily what would for us be the full formula and the more common benefit mechanism for most public pension systems. it's pretty easy to figure out how to apply that. It is not easy to figure out how to apply it to money management. So even with the help of outside tax experts, the meaning of the rules has proven exceedingly difficult, and we are at the stage now where we're going to attempt to get an advice letter from the IRS on exactly what is an accrued benefit. Because what there is in guidance does not allow us to determine that from the point of view of money match. We simply cannot determine for sure that what we're looking at as a benefit is the same thing that they're looking at. Now, I hope this brief overview has given you some kind of idea of the kinds of decisions and how we approach those decisions. But I would be more than happy, and actually am very happy that this is reaching the point of having some public discussion about this, because most of these decisions are not decisions that can, in fact, be made by the board. As Jim said, setting the policy under most circumstances is not our duty. Our duty is to carry out the policy that has been set by you, and to do that legally and within all the rules. Thank you very much for your time.
Chair Morgan, besides your having to make a decision to determine the most appropriate method to use in order to change out the out-of-date mortality tables, would you say that the biggest thing on your plate is kind of that fork in the road on the how to credit a deficit to the for the gain loss reserve, if that were possible? And there's equal crediting and there's sequential crediting. I think we've all heard those terms. But is this the biggest decision besides mortality tables that the board has to take up in the near future?
It's the biggest decision in the short run. And it's a decision that we have to make by the end of this year, simply because the statute requires that we credit earnings within that calendar year. And so we have determined that we can credit for members, but we cannot credit for employers. And so that's the piece that's hanging out there.
How much money, excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Smith.
How much money are we talking about?
At this point, we're talking about where to credit the deficit. And so we're not talking about where to put dollars. We're talking about where to put zeros. And that can make a big difference.
Yes, obviously.
And we don't want to do it wrong, believe me.
So what you, I just want to be clear, what you're saying is that you believe you have the authority to credit essentially a deficit.
We have an obligation to credit it.
An obligation to credit the deficit to the employee accounts.
Some employee accounts, in fact, do have deficits credited, those in variable and those in Tier 2. Those, in fact, do get credited with whatever the earnings or the negative earnings are.
But you can't, so to speak, credit a debt or a deficit to Tier 1 or to the employer.
We can credit negative earnings to the employer. We cannot credit them to Tier 1 members.
But you haven't made the determination yet of how you're going to do that with the employer?
We can't yet. No, we have postponed that until we can get some better idea based on the new look that we've had at what the statutory scheme would say is the appropriate mechanisms, and it's still in flux. It is not shaken out yet.
It would be helpful, I think, for the committee if we could get from either Jim or from the board the definition or the...
We do have a schematic.
Or the explanation.
Pretty close.
The explanation of, you know, equal crediting versus sequential crediting, because it's obviously complicated, and I don't think we'd want to take the time today to go through that. And
I agree.
We probably would prefer to read it and reread it. And
and like I said, there's both an explanation and then there's, you know, for those of us who are visual, there's a drawing that shows how you get from A to B, and that's, for me anyway, that was more helpful, although it's incredibly complicated.
It looks more like an abstract, doesn't it?
Yes, it does look a bit abstract.
Yes. Any other questions for the chair?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today.
Thank you. I suspect we'll be back again.
We invite you to come back again, and we hope you'll come back and as we work through this process and correct us where we may not have the factual information, because that's what we're attempting to do, is find out all the facts and then educate people on what the facts are and then look at potential solutions to, I think, what most everyone would admit is a daunting task, as you say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I need to announce the work group. Obviously, this particular task force is not going to do this work alone. So we've asked for volunteers, so to speak, to be on this work group. And so the work group members are as follows. I will chair the work group. Representative Butler's and Representative Hobson will help in that regard. Mary Botkin from AFSCME, Bill Connerly, Brian DeLashmit, Maria Kellner, Bob Livingston, Rich Peppers, Craig Rossler, Joe Schwinnert, Hasina Squires, Jack Solis, Les Stiles, who is my sheriff, by the way, from Deschutes County, and Tricia Bozak will be part of that work group, and we will convene after we adjourn this task force, which I suspect will be shortly.
Mr. Chair, Craig Rossler is a superintendent of one of my schools, so thank you very much.
Well, I had no idea you had an insider within the work group. That's,
yes.
That's impressive that you got him in there.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Any other questions or comments from members of the task force before we adjourn? If not, the task force on PERS sustainability will adjourn for the day, and the work group will meet as soon as we can gather around the table. Mm-hmm.